Today's Teisho will be on case 50 in the Heikigan Roku. Case 50 is entitled Umon's Particle After Particles Samadhi. Engo's introduction. Transcending all ranks, rising above all expedience, spirit corresponding to spirit, words answering words. Unless he has undergone the great emancipation and attained the great use of it, how could he rank with the Buddhas and be a faultless exponent of the teachings? Now tell me, who can be so direct and adaptable to all occasions and have the free command of transcendent words? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is particle after particles samadhi? Umon said, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Sencho's verse, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Even the most talkative can add nothing. The north and south stars do not change places. Heaven-touching waves arise on land. If you doubt, if you hesitate, though heir to millions, trouserless. So I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning to practice the Great Way. You know, it's so wonderful to be able to sit for a longer period of time, especially sitting together and purifying body, mind, and heart. You know, it takes a half a day of sitting to really ground yourself and free yourself from the obstacles that are holding you back or holding you down or causing you distress. So this is a wonderful opportunity, and I thank you for doing such an excellent job. You know, I can see everybody sitting there so still for hours. So this koan involves Master Cloud Gate, Yunmen Umon. And one of Umon's monks asked him, what is particle after particle samadhi? Which is a quotation from sutra, basically. What is the samadhi of particle after particle? So that's the first part of this koan. So, it takes a long time to change ourselves, to transform ourselves. We are socialized into ways of thinking and ways of experiencing that have a kind of powerful hold on us. You know, it would be nice if we could just sit down on the cushion and sit for half an hour and feel better, and maybe go to a couple of sesshins, and we would be totally transformed. But actually, it takes a little longer than that, because these habits, these mental habits, which our society has inculcated with, have kind of enduring quality. So, you know, a lot of Zen practice is, first of all, learning how to experience the world in a new way. And then in the process, it's like unlearning so much of what we were told was the case. A number of years ago, I remember reading an interview with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama was, the interviewer was talking to the Dalai Lama about things like mindfulness, the popularity of mindfulness practice. And the Dalai Lama is a really lovely person. You know, years ago, like
40 years ago, he came to the Seattle Zen Center. He came to our Zen Center and sat with us, believe it or not. This was before he was sort of like a superstar. And what had happened a little earlier was that my second teacher, Webb Roshi, used to go to Dharamsala before he would lead a tour group in China. So he would go to Dharamsala and he would meet with the Dalai Lama, actually, and then he would go into China, and as he was going around Tibet with his tour group, he would be meeting with lamas and giving them information or instruction from the Dalai Lama, sort of like secret instruction, right? So he was working basically as a kind of informal or furtive courier for the Dalai Lama's network in China, on the mainland. And he struck up quite a friendship with a number of Tibetans. And at one time in Seattle, there was a man named Geshe. Geshe is like a honorific term, like professor. Geshe is a degree. It's like a PhD in Tibetan Buddhist studies. And Geshe Darge was living in Seattle. And he was this very famous Tibetan teacher who was actually at one time the teacher of the Dalai Lama, even though they were roughly contemporary in age. And Geshe Darge would come and sit with us. A number of Tibetans would come over and sit with us. And they didn't have like Zen posture. You know, we Zen people put a lot of emphasis on nice straight backs and hands folded and straight head, you know. And actually, it helps enormously. Posture is important. These Tibetans would come in their, orange or rose-colored robes, right? And they would sit down and they'd sort of be like this, you know. They look, you know, like laundry bags over in the corner. But actually, you know, they wouldn't move a muscle for an hour and a half. They were absolutely motionless. They were in deep samadhi. So, you know, I certainly had a lot of respect for these Tibetan monks who would come and sit with us. And the Dalai Lama came because we had these connections, and he spent a day at our temple and had Japanese dinner, which he enjoyed. And that was a lovely day. Years later, I heard this interview with the Dalai Lama, and he was being asked about the popularity of mindfulness meditation. And he's a lovely person, and he's extremely diplomatic. He's a very good diplomat, you know, so he's careful not to be critical, but to be affirmative in a kind of critical, gentle, critical way, you know. So what he said was, they asked him about the popularity of mindfulness, and he really kind of said in a very nice way, you know, this practice takes a long time, to change our mental habits. And he was kind of saying, just being mindful isn't really going to do it, you know. It's very tactful, but it was definitely saying, it's a little harder to change, to free ourselves, than doing a little sitting. And that really stuck with me. Has stuck with me. We live in a society where we are told certain things, and then we sit down on the cushion and we start experiencing like an alternate reality, almost, right? It contradicts our understanding of the world in numerous ways, great and small. But because our habits are so ingrained, it takes a long time for us to change. It's like there's learning that has to happen, and then there's unlearning. And in some ways, the unlearning process takes longer than the learning process. As you know, so if you're doing Zen to improve your health or deal with stress, all of that's excellent. But if you're your goal is to wake up. You know, it takes a while. It's a lifetime project, you know. But very good one, very nice life, you know. But this unlearning part is complicated. So look, when we begin to do meditation practice, right? You know, we learn how to sit on the cushion. If we're in Zen tradition, we learn how to sit on the cushion with a straight back, balanced posture, breathing through the hara, you know, and we're watching the breath. And, you know, at first, this is a novelty, and then it becomes difficult, you know. So there's a period in our Zen training where we're trying to focus on the breath and the mind is wandering, and we're trying to focus on the breath and the mind keeps wandering. And, you know, that's a struggle. But, you know, sooner or later, people begin to enter this state of like altered consciousness, which is called samadhi. And, you know, it may take a month or it may take 2 months, but sooner or later, people will have this samadhi experience. And it's usually quite lovely, right? It's like, you know, you sit down on the cushion and you're full of anxiety about what's happened. These tape loops are playing in your head. You keep trying to get to the breath. And it's a struggle, you know, but at some point, you know, a couple of weeks in, a month in, you sit down on the cushion and you're just in this wonderful place, right? It's like suddenly, it's like the still point in the turning world, right? You're suddenly like grounded and it feels wonderful. Right? And then, you know, you may be so absorbed in this experience of samadhi that you don't even notice the time. And after like an hour has gone by, the bell rings and you feel like, oh, already? It's over already. This experience of samadhi is pretty dramatic sometimes. And even in cases where it's not dramatic, it's very pleasant, very beautiful. You know, and then basically, we get off the cushion and we go out and do what we have to do. And the next time we sit down, you know, may be hard to get back to that place. You may find yourself just where you were before, you know, caught in your mental loops, rehearsing events of the day. And you may feel frustrated, like you can't get back to that place. If you keep going, if you keep practicing, it gets to be easier and easier to be in samadhi. You get there more often, with greater regularity, and more deeply. You know, I remember, you know, when I first started practicing Zen and began to have samadhi experiences, it would take me like a whole hour and a half to get into samadhi. So, you know, I would sit down, we would do three, in the Seattle Zen Center, I often would sit in the morning, and in our morning sits, we would have three sits, and after the third sit, we would have like breakfast, you know, rice gruel, maybe miso soup, some vegetables, and skimono, some pickles, right? And that was breakfast. And sometimes an egg, a raw egg on our hot rice with soy sauce and green onions. We would sit like that, and it would take me like almost the whole time. Just towards the end, I'd be getting into deep samadhi. And a lot of us started training at the same time. And one time we asked Genki Roshi, how long does it take you to get into samadhi? And he didn't really understand the question at first because he was always in samadhi, you know, and he said, oh, as soon as I sit down. He would say, I feel like a stick of incense. He'd say, I would sit down on the cushion, and he basically said, you know, would feel like I'm disappearing from the top of my head, and the incense would burn down, and when it got down to the mat, I was gone. For many years, I would sit in the morning very close to Genki Roshi, sometimes right next to him. And he didn't move a muscle. It was just, he was absolutely like gone, right? So, it took me an hour and a half to get to that place. But the more you sit, the more regularly you'll get there and the more deeply you get there. And it's a lovely thing. And it's one of the reasons a lot of people stick with Zen practice. But they don't really appreciate, because of our cultural conditioning, what is actually happening in the samadhi experience. So, it is blissful and it is peaceful and grounding, right? It's really quite wonderful after a stressful day to be able to just enter deep samadhi. But because of our conditioning, it takes a long time to appreciate what's happening. We believe that the self is the thinker. That the source of all of our thoughts and all of our sensations and perceptions is the self. And this is a fundamental belief of Western civilization. In our culture, there's this very famous French philosopher named Descartes. And, Descartes tried to study his mental processes, which is actually something people hadn't done before. People believed in the soul, but they didn't really pay attention to the mind, right? So Descartes was this French philosopher who said, let's just pay attention to the mind, forget about the soul. And Descartes watched the workings of his mind, and he came to the conclusion that the self, the one thing you know for sure, is the I, and that all the thoughts come out of the I, This is his famous, I think, therefore I am. This is very famous Western. So all Western people pretty much accept this as obvious. But actually, when we do meditation and we enter samadhi, it contradicts what Descartes says. Because, you will enter long periods of focused consciousness, and only occasionally will you reference yourself, or will you have an I. So, one of the reasons samadhi feels so beautiful is that the I is not there, and we begin to feel like we're in this, like you would say, impersonal or transpersonal flow. It's like a stream of consciousness, but it's not centered on the I. It's just consciousness. And there's an I once in a while, like bobbing up out of the water. There's like, I, So it's a very different experience of consciousness than what we've been told, right? So we sit down on the cushion, we enter samadhi. There's this like stream of thoughts, pieces of thoughts, sensation, memories, and they're going by. And, that begins to thin out. That begins to become more placid. And there's fewer thoughts. And self-referencing becomes much less frequent. And because of the way we've been educated, we don't think about the consequences of this. But it's really important. Consciousness can persist without an I. That's actually quite big news, right? That the I is not the source of consciousness. The I is produced by consciousness. So then you say, well, where does the consciousness come from? See, that's a great question. Most people don't ask that question. They're just happy to feel better, right? They're just happy to feel better. And I'm so glad they do. But when we enter samadhi, it takes a long time to discover, for people to realize, why does this feel so good? And it may be a long time before you notice that you're not self-referencing, that you have consciousness without, you have thinking without a thinker. You have thoughts without a thinker. Yes, absolutely. See, this is like Buddhism 101, but because of our culture, we just walk by this over and over again. Thoughts without a thinker. So where are these thoughts coming from? Now, that's very interesting. The other thing that happens when you're in samadhi is, when you begin to stop self-referencing, this sense of distance between yourself and everything else around you begins to disappear. This is quite common. So like if you do five periods of meditation on a Saturday, and then you come to Sesshin, and you know, after day two of Sesshin, you walk outside, everything seems so intimate. It's like intimate. It's like the grass is you. The trees are you. You know, and that, how is that possible? You know, and you can say, well, it's subjective. But actually, it's not subjective, right? It's absolutely 100% actually objective, what's actually happening right now. So you know, our conditioning, our culture tells us one thing, and our experience tells us another. You know, so long after we've been practicing Zen, we'll still think of ourselves when we're off the cushion going through the day as the center of our consciousness, because that's a deeply ingrained habit. But little by little, the more you spend time in samadhi, the less compelling that story becomes, and the more obvious it becomes that you're not grounded in yourself, that the self is just arising along with all these other things, and that you're like a witnessing consciousness watching the self come and go. And when this happens, of course, we begin to treat our experience differently too. So, you know, when we imagine ourselves as the center of our awareness, you know, our thoughts feel like us. Our thoughts feel, you know, my thought, if all my thoughts are coming from me, my thoughts are me. So when I feel anger, that's me. And when I feel happiness, that's me. There's very difficult to get any space, any distance between yourself and your mental processing. But when you begin to be able to enter samadhi, this impersonal awareness, non-personal, transpersonal awareness, it's very easy to see your thoughts come and go without being attached to them, without feeling they're yours. You know, it's like you don't have to take ownership of this anger. It's like a cloud in the sky. It's just coming by. And when you stop imagining it as a revelation of who you are, and you just realize this is just an emotion, right? It's just an emotion. You don't have to hold on. You don't have to be angry. I don't have to be angry. I don't have to be worried. You know, this is actually a state people enter fairly early in their practice, right? But they don't appreciate it or understand it because of their conditioning. So a lot of Zen practice is like learning and then having to unlearn, right? Learning and then having to unlearn. And the harder part is the unlearning, right? And the way we do that is partly through koan practice, right? But a lot of it is just by going into the samadhi state, right? And little by little, it's like you change your mental habits. It's like one sit at a time, you're changing your mental habits, right? And, you know, according to Buddhist teaching, you know, what gives our lives a kind of coherence is nothing but these mental habits that we cultivate, right? So, you know, we change ourselves by doing something different over and over again. And in that process, we change our mental habits until we're very different people. So that's the unlearning part. You know, Reb Roshi went through kind of a crisis in his life at one point. And he began to practice tea ceremony, sado. And, you know, if you know anything about the tea ceremony, it's this very choreographed, very scripted way of making and serving tea. Every action in the tsado, in the tea ceremony, is scripted or dictated by tradition. So, you know, you when you come into the room, you have to, you know, you have your, in some forms of tea ceremony, you have your implements set in front of you. There's a tea bowl. There's the ladle. There's the whisk. And each of these things has to be, and there's a cloth, wiping cloth, in the bowl. Each of these things has to be cleaned ritually. You know, so you use the tea ladle, you put water in the bowl, you pour the water out into the wastewater bowl, then you wipe it, then you do the tea ladle, then you do the whisk, and so on. Then you serve the tea, you make it's all fair. Every time you do tea ceremony, it's exactly the same. But you know, Webb went through this crisis and he began to do tea ceremony. He did it like every week. He would go to the tea. Seattle has a beautiful tea house built by these wonderful Japanese craftsmen. There's no nails. It's all joinery, the whole thing. And it's in the Seattle Arboretum. And every Saturday he would go and do tea ceremony. And, you know, this repetitious behavior is powerfully liberating because you're undoing, unlearning old mental habits and relearning deep samadhi consciousness. You know, when you do tea ceremony, you go into deep samadhi, you know. So a lot of Zen practice is actually about repeating these processes until it changes the way, till we unlearn what we've been told. And, you know, this process goes on and on. It's like our practice runs ahead of our ability to understand and be changed by our practice, if that makes any sense. So, you know, your experience on the cushion is going to be difficult to understand a lot of the time until you keep repeating it and you are changed enough to understand it. So this is why, you know, even if you could have a Daikensho experience on the cushion, you know, it wouldn't be worth very much because you wouldn't understand it and you wouldn't be able to change in response to that. So this idea of practicing regularly, making this part of your life, is absolutely crucial. And your experiences will run ahead of your ability to explain what has happened to yourself, you know. So another thing that happens that doesn't make sense from the conventional standpoint and takes a long time to soak in is the next stage in our practice. So, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we go into deep mushin and we enter samadhi, we might not understand it this way, but we're beginning to enter like this stream of consciousness that is impersonal. And the self is not the source of this, but it pops up periodically. Okay. So if we stay in that state for a long time, we begin to notice something else. You know, it's like when you're in that state of concentration, you begin to notice that each moment is not... that the stream of consciousness is not continuous. It's not continuous. It seems continuous for a long time, but eventually you begin to notice that when your consciousness is no longer so crude, you begin to notice that the stream of consciousness is not really a stream of consciousness. That you have a moment of consciousness, and then there's like an interruption, and then there's another moment of consciousness. And then there's an interruption, and then there's another. It's like not continuous. So there's a moment of consciousness, and then there's like a little break, like a little break or a little blank space. Then there's another moment of consciousness. Now, this takes a long time to notice because of our mental habits. We're not expecting it. We're not looking for it. So you might have to sit for a long time. Zen sort of gives you a shortcut. Right? Zen says, let's meditate on emptiness. So the teacher can actually say to you, look, at the end of your breath, do you notice that there's a blank place there? And, you know, most people who have been meditating for a couple of years can find that blankness. And, you know, at first, when you experience that blankness, it's just, it's like that. It's so fast, it's just a little glimpse and then it's gone. But, you know, if you keep practicing, you keep going to that blank place, you'll notice that it changes. It seems to change because you're changing. At first, you just have this little experience of nothingness, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any significance, doesn't change anything. Your experience has run ahead of your ability to absorb it. But, you know, then you have, you know, you start sitting in this blankness. You start calling Mu, and your mind goes blank. And you'll notice that the character of the blankness changes. It becomes sustained. So instead of being like a finger snap, you can stay in that blankness for a long time, right? You can stay there for, you know, increasingly long time. Sometimes it feels like everything in the world has disappeared. See? And in that state, you know, you can feel like absolutely nothing exists, you know. So at first it seems like a finger snap. Eventually it becomes very sustained as you're able to be with it, you know. And then, you know, an interesting thing happens. You know, if you could get into that blankness, you might think to yourself, I'm going to love staying here forever, right? So you try to get into that blankness and just stay in that blankness deeper, deeper, deeper. But, you know, you can't stay there. No matter how deeply you go into Mushin, you won't be able to avoid coming out of it. Because actually, Mushin is just one part of something bigger. You know, you go into that emptiness and you go down and everything seems to disappear. And then all of a sudden, the world comes back. It's like everything, you become aware of the birds outside, or you become aware of the pain in your legs, or you feel cold on your face. And you might think, oh, why can't I hold on to that blankness? See, this is misunderstanding. You know, actually, the blankness and the something and nothing are like a process. It's like the way the river is mostly something, and it's interrupted by nothing, and then it's something again, and then it's nothing again. So there's like this alternating cycle of like nothingness and then something, and nothingness and something. And you know, basically, this is like really another great discovery. If you've experienced this on the cushion, congratulations. This is like big discovery, right? But it's another discovery that takes a long time to soak in. You know, what the implications of this are, really, really important. You know, very radical, very radical. You know, if I'm not the center of consciousness, if I'm just a product of consciousness, then consciousness is moving along like this stream, and I'm arising in that stream, and then I go back into the stream. You know, I'm in and out of that stream. Consciousness is this stream, and consciousness is not like it has this quality of being like a stream, and then there's nothing, and then it's a stream, and then there's nothing, and a stream, and then there's nothing. This is all like very strange, right? For people who practice for a long time, it will take you a long time before you put it all together. Your experience is going to run ahead of your understanding. You know, the Buddha was asked to explain enlightenment. And this goes back to the Pali Sutras. This is the early, early Buddhist sutras. And you probably have heard the parable of the elephant, right? You know, the blind men and the elephant. You know, basically, the parable says, you know, seven blind men encountered an elephant and wanted to understand the elephant using just the sense of touch. you know, and one blind man grabs the elephant's leg and says an elephant is like a tree. And another blind man grabs the elephant's ear and says the elephant is like a leaf. And another person grabs his tail, says the elephant is like a snake, and so on. And, you know, the Buddha used this metaphor to make the point that, you know, our experience of enlightenment is going to be partial, incomplete, and maybe even incoherent for a long time before we suddenly realize, oh, it's an elephant. So, you know, there's this process in Zen of like making a discovery and then not being able to take it in and returning to it again and again, and gradually we're changed by that experience. You know, and when people understand, when people encounter mu again, they don't necessarily understand it. It's just this emptiness. And when you go into mu, it's incredibly liberating, right? So, you know, if you can get into deep mu shin, pretty much no matter what has happened to you, you know, you're going to be able to free yourself from your emotional distress. It's if you practice going into mu shin, it's so transformative and purifying. It's really this wonderful, liberating experience. And people know that after a while. It becomes like a tool for living. But they don't understand like the larger implication or what it really means in terms of the whole elephant. So, you know, actually, you know, this koan is kind of talking, this koan, I'm actually talking about the koan, even though it doesn't seem to be the case. A monk asked Umon, what is particle after particle samadhi? And Umon said, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. So Umon is talking about the fact that we have these experiences first, and then if we keep practicing and repeating them, it begins to change the way we experience the world from moment to moment. It's like we absorb this and it changes our mental habits. So, you know, it seems like there's the world of Zen practice, you know, sitting on a cushion, entering mu shin, entering samadhi, and then there's the world we live in, right? The world of, how does he put it? Rice in a bowl and water in a pail, right? And those things can seem very, very separate. You know, people often have this experience of, especially after sesshin, you know, you on about day three of sesshin, it's like you feel so deeply connected. Everything's so alive and you seem so free. And then you get home and after a couple of weeks, you feel like you're back in the same place. You're really not, but there's this sense of split, of separation. You know, it is true that you're not exactly in the same place after 2 weeks after the sesshin, but, you know, you keep going to sesshin, and little by little, the world you come back to is very, very changed. So there's like this process, right? This process of having these experiences, and they're strange and wonderful, but then it takes a while before they sort of like soak in, before they begin to really change who you are and how you experience the world. And this is the process of Zen practice. So, you know, when you have spent a lot of time experiencing the something and nothing cycle, right, where you're going into, you sit down on the cushion, the birds are singing, et cetera, et cetera. You go into deep mu shin, everything disappears, then it comes back. You watch the breath, you go into deep mu shin, everything disappears and it comes back. It takes a long time before you begin to appreciate what is happening, right? And it's pretty radical, you know, pretty radical. It's so radical you might not even be ready to accept it. You know, that's the other thing, you know, it takes a while before people understand, you know. So Dogen says something really interesting, you know. Dogen says, we think that there's wood, then there's fire, then there's ashes. That's how we think. So first there's wood, then there's fire burning in the fireplace, and then there's ashes. It seems so obvious, right? But actually, you know, Dogen says that's not how reality really works. Yeah, he says that, you know, every moment is like fresh universe, fresh universe. So, you know, the Zen view is, you know, that every moment is like the universe 100%, and then everything is gone. And then, you know, the universe comes back and it's 100% universe, and then everything is gone. And then it's 100% universe and everything is gone. It's like, you know, it's like the universe itself. We say, well, that must be continuous, but maybe it's not. You know, maybe it really is the case that everything exists and then it stops existing. And there's like this, maybe there's an oscillation in reality between something and nothing. Maybe it's just in the human mind, but it's very important. You know, when you begin to experience this moment as part of this oscillation, you know, the moment becomes so alive, and it's like you feel so liberated by this experience, right? It's like at this moment, there's just this moment. And if you do a lot of zazen, you know, you do a lot of sitting on the cushion, you have these moments where, especially at Sesshin, you'll suddenly realize, you know, this moment is all there is and all there's ever going to be. You know, this is like eternal moment, an infinite moment. And it's so obvious, right? And then we say, well, you know, that was just an experience. But, you know, actually that may be how reality is. That may be a more accurate understanding of the way things are than ordinary consciousness can accomplish or accommodate. Yeah. So, you know, I was a few years ago, there were some brain scientists who were studying people who are in these very advanced states of meditation. They were looking at Tibetan meditators, primarily non-Zen meditators, but they go through very similar experiences. And these two brain scientists who said, they went on record as saying, we actually think that their understanding of reality is more accurate than our understanding of reality. They said, you know, basically our everyday way of thinking about things contains a lot of confusion and misrepresentations that these people don't have gotten past. So anyway, whether the universe is continuous or discontinuous, and whether the universe arises and vanishes over and over again in some kind of great oscillation, we definitely experience that world, experience the world that way when we meditate for a long time. And it has a profound and transformative effect on us. And that's what this koan is pointing to. So, Engo's introduction, transcending all ranks, rising above all experience, spirit corresponding to spirit, words answering words. Unless he has undergone the great emancipation and attained the great use of it, how could he rank with the Buddhas and be a faultless exponent of the teachings? See, so the point here is, look, you know, it takes a long time for this to soak in, right? I don't think any of us can say we are transcending all ranks or rising above all expedience yet. But, you know, our experience runs ahead of our ability to understand it, but gradually, it makes sense. Now tell me, who can be so direct and adaptable to see all occasions and have the free command of transcendent words? See the following. A monk said to Umon, what is particle after particle samadhi? Umon says, you know, basically, he's saying to the monk, you have experienced particle and after particle of samadhi, but do you understand what it means in your own life? Do you understand what it means in your own experience? Rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Secho's verse, rice in the bowl, water in the pail. Even the most talkative can add nothing. That's like complete integration. The north and south stars do not change places. Heaven-touching waves arise on land. In other words, not the way we imagine the world. If you doubt, if you hesitate, though heir to millions, you have no pants, basically. So he's really saying here, please keep practicing. Please trust the process. You know, a lot of what happens on the cushion doesn't make sense right now. But, you know, you have to grow into your experiences on the cushion. You have to allow yourself to be changed until they make sense, and they will make sense. You know, one day the elephant will be standing before you. So everybody came here today to practice the great way, and all of you come into Dokusan, and you're making these breakthroughs. And for a long time, it may not feel like anything is happening, and then one day you realize you're a very different person. This is a way to Buddhahood. So thank you for making an excellent effort today.